Today's guest is Dr. David Albala. He is a distinguished urologist, graduated with a geology degree from Lafayette College and earned his MD from Michigan State University. He completed his surgical residency at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and an andrology fellowship at Washington University under Ralph V. Clayman. At Loyola University, he rose to professor in urology and radiology. He later became a tenured professor at Duke University, where he co-directed the andrology fellowship and directed the Center for Minimally Invasive and Robotic Urological Surgery. Currently, he is Chief of Urology at Krauss Hospital and Medical Director for Associated Medical Professionals. He has authored numerous publications and textbooks and has been a visiting professor worldwide. We welcome Dr. Albala to the podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the best of the SIU Issue 2. Today, we're going to have three exciting papers that we're going to discuss. My name is Dr. David Albala. I'm Chief of Urology at Krauss Hospital in Syracuse, New York, and it's really a pleasure to review these papers with you. The three papers that we're going to talk about are early results after thelium laser enucleation of the prostate in patients with urodynamically proven detrusor underactivity. We're going to then talk about the safety and efficacy of bilateral tubeless supine mini percutaneous nephrolithotomy for patients with bilateral renal calculi and renal failure patients. And then we're going to look at the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program, looking at transfusions in radical cystectomy and how it increases overall morbidity and mortality. And this is going to be using the data from the American College of Surgeons. So we have a nice array of topics today to discuss: a cancer paper, a stone paper, and then a BPH paper. So let's get to it. The first paper we're going to talk about is the early results with thelium laser enucleation of patients with BPH and urodynamically proven detrusor underactivity. As we all know, benign prostatic hyperplasia is a very common urological disease. And among these patients, we do see patients that present with detrusor underactivity or detrusor acontractility. And these patients really are a challenge to us, and there's really no medical treatment that's available. And the aim of this paper, which came out of Austria and Switzerland, is to evaluate early-term outcomes following thelium laser enucleation of the prostate. So we're going to be looking at outcomes of this high-risk group of patients that have detrusor underactivity and acontractility. In this paper, the authors looked at 115 patients that underwent thelium laser enucleation for lower urinary tract symptoms, and also looked at patients that had proven detrusor underactivity. We defined detrusor underactivity as a bladder contractility index of less than 100. Patients that had neurogenic bladders, prostate cancer, or previous surgery due to BPH were excluded in this study. And patients had with indwelling catheters, their IPSS scores were determined before the catheterization was undertaken. And these patients had urodynamic studies done in accordance with the EAU guidelines in good urodynamic practices. So in this population, 8 patients were proven to have detrusor underactivity. 7 of the 8 patients were catheter-free post-surgery. Actually, all of the patients, 8 out of 8 patients, 2 months were catheter-free. When we look at the one-year results with the patients that underwent thelium laser enucleation, all the patients at 1 year were still catheter-free. And we did see improvements in flow rates, the Qmax. We did see improvements in the quality of life and post-void residual at 2 months post-operatively. There was no significant difference with symptom scores and voided volumes in these patients. So let's drill down and look at these patients a little more carefully. We can see that the average age group in this patient population was about 73. We can see that the serum PSA was about 2.6. You can see the range from 1.4 to 4.4. You can see the flow rates before the surgical procedure. The IPSS score was 15, and the quality of life score was 3.5. after they underwent their procedure, you can see that the IPSS score dropped from 15 to 7. So almost a 50% drop off in the symptom score. Quality of life score improved. You can see that the flow rate went from 4.4 to 21.6 cc's. You can see that the post-void residuals dropped from 189 cc's to zero. And then you can see the voided volumes went from 90 to 246 cc's in this patient population. So when you look at this, the importance of precision medicine in establishing a functional diagnosis in patients with lower urinary tract symptoms is increasing. There's some authors that consider laser enucleation, whether it be with epithelium or a HOLAP, is the next gold standard for bladder prosthetic obstruction surgical management. The British upstream study hypothesized that the identification of detrusor underactivity would reduce surgery rates. And I think this study shows that functional outcomes in patients that have pressure flow studies were non-inferior to routine care, but was more expensive. And there was no impact on the rate of surgical procedures that could be demonstrated in this study. So, unlike transurethral resection of the prostate, which many of us believe is the gold standard, laser enucleation clearly has anatomical templates that are defined and effective to allow the enucleations to occur. There are mixed results in this patient population with a TURP, looking at detrusor underactivity or detrusor acontractility. If we look at the literature, Lomas and Krambeck have written about HOLAP, showing that it's effective and a durable solution for patients with bladder outlet obstruction, especially in patients that have detrusor underactivity or acontractility. Their catheter-free rates were 89% in detrusor underactivity, and with detrusor acontractility, 62%. Mitchell and all reported catheter-free rates in this population of 100% and 94%, with a median follow-up of 2 years. And you can see that pressure flow studies at 6 months showed a significant return of detrusor function in 79% of men that have detrusor acontractility. Chow and all reported long-term surgical outcomes and quality of life after laser enucleation in this patient population. The EUA guidelines recommend, obviously, enucleation of the prostate for larger prostates with a prostate volume greater than 80 cc's. There are no clear conclusions for small prostate volumes, but clearly this population may benefit from this, but further work needs to be done. Preoperative pressure flow studies can be essential for the selection of the operative approach because patients that have high rates of detrusor underactivity or detrusor acontractility, these patients can be offered enucleation and may benefit from that. And according to the EAU guidelines in 2022, thelium-based enucleation is a valid alternative to other enucleation techniques that are available. So the authors conclude that thelium laser enucleation leads to high catheter-free rates. It improves functional voiding parameters such as quality of life in BPH and detrusor underactivity patients. In the future, laser enucleation can be considered a treatment approach for patients that have detrusor underactivity and detrusor acontractility. And the importance of urodynamics as a tool for precision medicine and lower urinary tract symptoms should be considered. And laser enucleation may be a reference procedure in this patient population. So, a very nice paper looking at a select group of patients with detrusor underactivity and detrusor acontractility. Thelium laser enucleation should be a procedure that can be considered with high rates of success in this patient population. The second paper, we're going to switch now into some stonework. This is a paper that came out of India looking at the safety and efficacy of bilateral tubeless supine mini percutaneous nephrolithotomy for the management of bilateral renal calculi in patients with renal failure. So we're looking at patients that have bilateral stones, they have renal failure. This is a complex and a very select group of patients looking at the effectiveness of the mini tubeless percutaneous nephrolithotomy. I think all of us know that stone disease is a common disease affecting 10 to 12% of the world population, and 12 to 26% of these patients have bilateral stone disease. Obstructive uropathy, can cause acute kidney injury, and this accounts for 10 to 12% of obstructive acute kidney insufficiency. We know that procedures such as a prone percutaneous nephrolithotomy has limitations such as requirements for anesthesia, prolonged operative times, increased perioperative morbidity, despite having good outcomes. And clearly, this has been the standard of care. And this study really looks at the safety, the efficacy, the feasibility, and stone-free rates, as well as complications with bilateral supine mini perc. And I think that this is a procedure that is gaining some popularity among surgeons, among stone surgeons. And in this patient population, they looked at patients with renal failure and looking at a single-stage procedure. So data was collected between January 2020 and March 2022. Patients that were on hemodialysis before the procedure were excluded from the procedure. And the demographic data, the medical history, physical examination, lab work, hematological and biochemical, as well as stone characteristics, were retrieved for evaluation. The operative time was calculated from the time the cystoscope's inserted into the patient to the completion of the skin suture. Complications were graded according to the Kalabian system for percutaneous procedures, and residual stone fragments less than 4 millimeters were considered insignificant. So these procedures were all performed under spinal anesthesia. The patients were initially placed in a lithotomy position for the cystoscopy and catheter placement. They were then repositioned into a supine Valdivia position for surgery, the supine position. The pelvic calyceal system was opacified and then punctured at the desired calyx location under fluoroscopic guidance. The needle was used, it was an 18-gauge needle, and a triangulation technique was applied to properly place the needle into the appropriate area. The tracts were dilated with Teflon dilators, and then a 20 French Amplatz sheath was placed, and then an 18 French mini nephroscope was used. The pneumatic lithoclast was used to fragment the stones, and the larger fragments were expelled by the Bruley phenomena of washing out of the stones. And additional punctures were made to ensure complete stone clearance took place. Here you can see are some illustrations looking at the patient in the supine position. You can see double J stents were placed after the stones were cleared. Typically, these were 5 French by 26 centimeters in length. The tract was blocked with ropivacaine. The nephrostomy tube infiltration was performed, and no patients were left with nephrostomy tubes. A compressive dressing was applied post procedure, and then using statistical significance of 0.05 was used. T-test and a chi-square test was used for quantitative and qualitative variables. And you can see in the first picture, the patient on the operating table, you can see the fluoroscopic view on the picture on the right. You can see where the needle is placed between the 12th rib and the iliac crest. You can see the posterior axillary line. And then postoperatively, you can see the surgical wound that's closed and the suture being placed there. Here is the results. 35 patients in renal failure underwent bilateral tubeless mini percs. 8 were excluded as they were on dialysis. So ultimately, 27 patients. You can see the mean age was 45. The majority of patients compared to females, male to female, was 16 to 11. The mean stone size was 2.4 centimeters. You can see many of these patients, comorbidity-wise, had diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and COPD. The operative times were about 75 minutes. You can see access was gained with a single access in the majority of patients, and the stone clearance rate was 92.5%. And then if you look at the Clavien complications, grade 1 and 2 and grade 4, you can see that 7% had significant complications, grade 4A, but the majority of patients had grade 1 and grade 2 complications. So you can see that 46, 10, and 4 renal units had lower, middle, and upper calyceal punctures, respectively. 6 units required 2 punctures for stone clearance. 4 patients did have a significant drop in their hemoglobin and hematuria. There was an immediate rise in the serum creatinines, which were significant initially. These eventually returned down. 2 patients postoperatively needed hemodialysis. 4 patients had a urinary tract infection. And you can see that the complete clearance rate was 25 out of 27 or 92.5%. 2 patients had residual fragments. And then when these patients were studied at 27 months, at 3 months postoperatively, all the patients were stone free at that time. So this is looking at some of the postoperative bleeding. You can see the drop in the hemoglobin from 11.95 to 10.67. Transfusion rate was in 4 patients. And you can see that the mean drop postoperatively hemoglobin, if the operative time was less than 90 minutes, was 2.5. If it was greater than 90 minutes, it was 1.06. In these patients. And here below, you can see the bump in the creatinine. You can see in patients that had, in the 27 patients that had a creatinine, the baseline was 2.78. This bumped up to 3.20. And then at 1 month, you can see it back drop down to 1.7. If we look at the 2 patients that required transient dialysis postoperatively, you can see the baseline was 3.4, so they had a higher creatinine than the patient population as a whole. You can see that immediately postoperatively, that creatinine bumped up to 5.6, but then at 1 month postoperatively, you see this dropping back down to 1.9. So we do know that percutaneous nephrolithotomy has emerged as the treatment of choice for stones that are greater than 2 centimeters. I think many of us that are endourologists realize the value of percutaneous nephrolithotomies. Traditionally, this has been done in a prone position. These authors looked at a supine percutaneous nephrolithotomy, and what they found is the operative time is reduced, as well as the need for general anesthesia. If we look at some of the literature, Freakus and all concluded that mini-perc is a reasonable alternative to patients that have a small to medium stone burden. And this tubeless procedure works quite well. It's safe, it's effective, there's less morbidity, and there's a shorter hospital stay, as well as pain requirements postoperatively when we compare this to a standard percutaneous nephrolithotomy in a prone position. The tubeless perc was cheaper. It seems to be more advantageous for uncomplicated multiple renal calculi, and there's a much faster postoperative recovery time. When we look at complications, all of these procedures are prone to complications. Urosepsis and renal damage can lead to hemodialysis, pneumonia, hydrothorax, but clearly this appears to be less frequent in the tubeless population when compared to a prone percutaneous nephrolithotomy. So I think this study demonstrated initial stone-free rates of 92.5%. The operative time was just over an hour at 75 minutes. The hospital stay was 3.7 days, and you can see that the mean fall in hemoglobin was 1.28 grams. You can see that 2 patients had Clavien 4A complications. The blood transfusion rates with the mini-perc tend to be much less than what we see with prone percutaneous nephrolithotomy. There is a transient increase in the serum creatinine levels. And however, at 1 month, this seems to go back to the baseline or even slightly below the preoperative levels. And you can see that in this study, upper calyceus punctures were used to remove four stones in that region. So the limitations of this study is that it's a retrospective study design. It's a small sample size, and there's lack of a comparative arm to look at, and cost analysis was not done. But I think the authors conclude, and I think rightly so, that bilateral tubeless supine mini-perc in a single session for bilateral renal calculi in a select patient population with renal failure is safe, it's feasible, and it's an effective option to try to treat patients. There's no increased morbidity, and it can be attempted if the first side mini-perc does reasonably well. I think many of us have done bilateral percutaneous nephrolithotomies, not only with the supine technique, but with the prone technique. But really, the key to doing bilateral simultaneous percs is that the first side has to go smoothly, no significant complications, and then you can proceed. And there are further studies that are really needed to assess the long-term impact on renal function. But a very interesting paper, a very select group of patients with renal failure. And I think that this does show that the mini perc, bilateral supine mini percs, is a viable option to try to treat these stone patients in this select group. The third paper, we're going to now go into a cancer paper looking at bladder cancer. And this is a paper using data from the American College of Surgeons. The American College of Surgeons has the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program. And this is from American University out of Lebanon, looking at patients that undergo cystectomy and looking at the transfusion and radical cystectomy increases overall morbidity and mortality. So this is a retrospective study. We do know that bladder cancer is a common problem worldwide. And radical cystectomy is a complicated procedure that's done for muscle invasive disease or non-invasive stage 2 to 4 uncontrolled after local resection with a transurethral resection or unresponsive bladder cancer. And we do know that radical cystectomy has significant complications. These patients have ileuses, they have pyelonephritis, small bowel obstruction, wound infections, cardiac arrhythmias, and urinary tract infections. And the incidence of complications is 64%. This patient population tends to be older, they're much sicker, they have multiple comorbidities, and this is a very big operation that does carry significant complication rates associated with it. And there are intraoperative and operative characteristics, that may impact morbidity and mortality. And what this study was to do is to understand the impact of postoperative transfusions on morbidity and mortality in radical cystectomy patients. So the American College of Surgeons data set looked at patients that underwent radical cystectomy between the years of 2008 and 2019. So this is an immense patient population. Over 16,000 patients underwent radical cystectomy for bladder cancer. And these were the CPT codes that were used to collect this data. Patients that had preoperative transfusions and emergency cases were excluded. So the final data set that was analyzed was 15,588 patients, an enormous data set, and 4,787 patients had perioperative blood transfusions before surgery. So the demographic, the age, the BMI, the ASA class, the comorbidities, and then the transfusion rates were compared. And the outcomes of surgical site infection, wound disruption, pneumonia, pulmonary emboli, ventilator use greater than 48 hours. And you can see the outcomes that were looked at, the complications that can be associated, cardiac arrest, requiring CPR, septic shock, return to the OR, all were studied. And the interested outcomes really were looking at the length of hospital stay and their impact on the 30-day morbidity and mortality in this patient population. The patients were one-to-one propensity matched according to demographics and the medical history. Chi-square and t-test were used to analyze the variables, and odds ratios were also calculated in this patient population. Now, this is a difficult slide to look at, but I want you to focus at a couple of things on here. The first thing you can see that in this patient population, the majority of patients were 60, 70, and greater than 80 years old. You can see that the younger patients make up a very small percentage of these patients. Next, you can look at the BMIs. The BMIs you can see hovering around 25 to 30 was the majority of patients. The very large obese patients greater than 40 BMI only represent about 5% of the study. You can see that clearly the majority of patients, quarters of the patients in the study were male to female. When you look at the ASA ranking, you can see the number of patients that had an ASA ranking greater than 2. So these are the patients that had multiple comorbidities. 81% or 82% of the patients in the study were considered ASA 2 or greater. And when you look at the breakdown of diversions, ileoconduits clearly were the major diversionary procedure done. You can see there were some neobladders that were also done that represent, 17% of the patients. If you look at the comorbidities, obviously diabetes, hypertension, similar comorbidities to what we see with our cystectomy patients here that we do in the United States. This is pretty consistent. These patients have COPD. Typically, they've been smokers for many, many years. And then you can look at the operative time of the operations is listed here at a mean of 329 to 367 minutes. So here is the results of the data. 1,700 patients, or 50% of patients, underwent a perioperative transfusion, and 50% of them did not. Those patients that underwent a perioperative transfusion had a longer hospital stay. Their mean hospital stay was about 9.3 days. Patients that underwent transfusion had higher rates of morbidity and mortality. If you look at the odds ratio, it was 1.9 and 1.4, respectively, for mortality and morbidity. And clearly, transfusion rates increase major morbidity through composite outcomes. And you can see this chart here, again, difficult to read, but looking at, the morbidities, urinary tract infections, cardiac arrest requiring CPR, DVT, and so on are listed in this chart. So I think in the discussion, perioperative transfusion rates in radical cystectomy has shown conflicting results in the literature. Clearly, the impact on morbidity and mortality is a topic of discussion. There have been several studies that have been able to demonstrate that transfusion has a detrimental effect on survival outcomes. And a systematic review reported that transfusion is associated with worst overall survival rates. But there are a few studies that have shown dose-dependent relationships between the number of units transfused and all-cause mortality and prolonged hospitalization. So I think what this study does show is that perioperative transfusion prolongs hospital stay. Transfusion rates increase the risk of infectious complications, cerebrovascular and cardiopulmonary and renal injury. It also reaffirms that transfusion is an independent predictor of morbidity and mortality in major abdominal surgeries. Obviously, secondary immunosuppression prompted by transfusion is attributed to an increased risk of morbidity and infections. And a more restrictive approach to blood transfusions during radical cystectomy is emphasized to reduce these postoperative complications. And the way we can do that is, identifying anemia early on. Iron deficiency and erythropoietin can be used to increase red blood cell mass. We can consider doing robotic-assisted surgery. At least in my country, in the United States, we're now seeing more and more radical cystectomies being done robotically. We can see norepinephrine and restrictive hydration to encourage a decreased need for blood transfusions. Are other techniques that can be used to reduce the risk of transfusing these patients, because this study shows, I clearly shows, that patients that get transfusions have longer hospital stays, they have greater overall morbidity, and the higher mortality in patients undergoing radical cystectomy has been shown in patients that do receive transfusions during the perioperative period. So if we can minimize the number of transfusions during radical cystectomy, there's no question that this will have a significant impact on the outcome of morbidity and mortality in this patient population. So a very interesting study looking at radical cystectomy. These patients, as I said, are very commonly sick. They have a significant risk factor for complications postoperatively. And obviously, if we can reduce transfusion rates, we can indeed try to reduce overall morbidity and mortality. So this session today, I think, looks at a nice array of papers involving BPH and the thelium laser. We looked at mini PERCs, supine mini PERCs for stones, and then we looked at a cancer paper in bladder cancer looking at transfusion rates with radical cystectomy. So this is the second session. I look forward to our third session, which will be coming very, very shortly. Thank you very much.